You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay, good morning. I think we can start. Welcome all of you. And I hope this is going to become a tradition. It's not quite a tradition yet. So I have this wonderful panel every year to look at Latin America in a global context. I really don't need to introduce at length, but very briefly, we have José Juan Ruiz Gómez next to me, chief economist and manager of the research department at the Inter-American Development Bank. He was among many positions, but the prior position, he was director of strategy and chief economist of the Latin American division of Banco Santander, and he held many other positions. He writes also now in El País, right? You continue.
From time to time.
Time to time. Augusto de la Torre is the chief economist, Latin America and Caribbean for the World Bank. He has held positions at the World Bank, at the IMF, and was the head of Central Bank of Ecuador. Then we have Alejandro Werner, who's the director of the Western Hemisphere Department of the IMF, who has held academic and private sector and public sector position, and he was the former Undersecretary of Finance and Public Credit in Mexico, an extremely important job. And he was also in private banking at BBVA Bancomer. And then we have Ernesto Talvi, who's our Brookings partner and CERES director. He is the director of the Brookings CERES Economic and Social Policy in Latin America Initiative, ESPLA, for those who want to remember it shortly. Ernesto is not only a highly valued friend and colleague, but somebody who really helps make global what it is, because global economics, of course, has to have a strong Latin American dimension. He held research positions at the IMF and the Central Bank of Uruguay and worked with the Inter-American Development Bank on global and regional macroeconomic and financial affairs. So, we're going to take a look, this panel is going to take a look at Latin America, and I'm told that the hashtag here, which you're encouraged to use, is LatinAmGrowth. LatinAmGrowth. but, you know, let me just say two or three words using the prerogative of the chair to launch it. First of all, of course, Latin America remains a very important part of the world economy. It remains, in the sense of its weight in the world economy, is still substantial. Asia has grown a lot, but Latin America, you know, being basically a middle-income continent, has tremendous weight still in the world economy. Second thing I wanted to say is that there is a debate, somewhat oversimplified debate, about convergence and divergence. Convergence and divergence in the sense, you know, do developing and emerging countries grow faster and in that sense converge ultimately, although the ultimate could be a long time. And there's a certain definition in one, you know, one can use certain definitions, but if there is a significant difference in the per capita income growth of emerging and developing countries, then we have a situation where gradually the world economy is kind of uniting the old division between developing countries, emerging countries, and rich, advanced countries would slowly disappear over 20, 30, 40 years or so. This was not at all the case until the late 1980s. And there is even a famous article in economics by Lan Pritchett, who's now at Harvard and the Center for Global Development, you know, divergence big time. In other words, convergence is not happening. The rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer, relatively speaking at least. And what some growth models would tend to point to, namely a certain convergence process, is not happening. And then in the late 80s, 90s, things changed. And when you take the aggregate of all emerging and developing countries, and compare the per capita income growth in that aggregate with the income growth in the advanced countries since the early 90s, we can see convergence in the aggregate. Okay? And in fact, pretty rapid convergence at rates that are quite significant for that period. However, this is in the aggregate. China is a very important part of this story, obviously. It's not the only part of that story. Others have also grown rapidly. But China is the... And you know, 3-4 years ago, you remember particularly when the crisis hit the advanced countries much more than the developing countries, the talk was, you know, the emerging markets are taking over, so to speak. One country that was extremely quoted during that period was Brazil. You know, Brazil had made it. Brazil was the El Dorado. I think there was a joke also on Brazil. Brazil is always a country that's about to make it, but this time it has really made it, kind of thing. And so we entered a quite a different optimistic area about convergence. And then things changed again over the last year. So much so that The Economist, in its 2 week ago edition, I think went overboard and said convergence is dead altogether, more or less, you know, in journalistic style. So I think for us at Brookings, at the Global Economy and Development Program, this is, of course, a very interesting question, not just a factual question, but it has to do with, you know, which policies help, which don't. It has to do with geopolitics. It has to do with international governance reforms, the weights at the IMF, for example, at the World Bank. It has to do with many aspects of how you manage the world economy and the G20, you know, the future of the G20 and all that. So it's against this background that really we've encouraged Ernesto and his colleagues to look at these issues from a Latin American perspective. And I think, I won't say more, but I think you will see that as always in economics, it's very hard to aggregate. When you disaggregate, you find that there are all kinds of different stories. I mean, the title of the booklet has a subtitle of Three Latin Americas and even perhaps more than that. So I will turn it over to Ernesto now. But I think the Latin American dimension of this is a very, very important part of a really global, fascinating global debate that's taking place. Ernesto.
Thank you very much, Kamal. Thank you.
I try to be tough with time because I have to. All of you.
We'll try our best. Well, first of all, I'm very happy to share the panel once again with the very good friends, Jose Juan, Augusto, Alejandro. Really, thank you very much for being here. We intended last year to for this event to become a classic, and we hope that we can continue the next. I would like to express my appreciation to the Brookings Communications team, Neil O'Reilly, Christina Golubski, and to S+ project coordinator, Vanessa Guerrero, who really are responsible for organizing this conference. And what I'm going to say is really teamwork. Teamwork by the team here in Washington, D.C., Guillermo Bulletin and Julia Ruiz, that are here with us, and the CERES team in Montevideo, Uruguay, Santiago García da Rosa, Rafael Xavier, Rafael Guntin, Federico Gans, and Mercedes Cejas. So with that, let me say that I'm going to be touching upon four issues. First, what is the new global outlook in the years to come, and what does it imply for Latin America? What are the macroeconomic challenges? What are the development challenges? And what are the political economy challenges that the region is going to face in the years to come? So first, with the exception of 2009, the year post Lehman crisis year, Latin America had a decade of uninterrupted growth. But during that decade, you can see two very clear phases. 2004 to 11, which is the period that we call the golden years, in which the region grew at a yearly average of 6%. And when I talk about the region, I'm talking about the seven major countries: Argentina, Chile, Colombia, Peru, Mexico, and Venezuela, which account for 93% of the region's GDP. Now, in the recent years, 2012, 2014, there has been a cooling off period. The region has slowed down significantly, and the rate of growth for 2014 is projected at a meager 2%. Now, only four external drivers or factors can account really with digital precision for these two phases. Growth in advanced economies, growth in China, the prices of commodities that Latin America both produces and exports, and international financing costs for emerging markets. So supersonic growth rates in China, exponential rise in commodity prices that actually quadrupled between 2004 and 2011, significant and persistent decline in international financing costs through 2004 to 2011, gave way to a substantial cooling off in China, softening in commodity prices, and the beginning of the end of the decline in international financing costs once the Fed announced its tapering in May 2013. So exuberance gave way to lackluster growth. So no outlook for the region can really be assessed if we do not assess what are the prospects for its very important key drivers of the business cycle in the region. So let's review one by one. The prospects for the U.S. advanced economies. The U.S. and the EU, especially the EU, are stuck in what now has been called secular stagnation. The investment-driven, credit-propelled model of growth in China has to come to an end in order to preserve the health of the banking system. So markets are expecting a further cooling off in China's growth rates. Markets are also expecting that commodity prices are to soften even further and that interest rates in the U.S. are going to gradually edge up. What does this all imply for Latin America? That for the five-year period ahead, the region is expected to grow at a mediocre 3 to 3.5%. So what does this reduction in the cruising speed of the region imply in terms of the challenges that it poses? Let's start by macroeconomic challenges. And among macroeconomic challenges, let's start by the banking system, which has been many times the weak link of the region. And there, what we see is that the tightening of regulation and supervision that the region has undertaken in the last 10 years has really paid off. When we conduct stress tests, really, although not as sophisticated as the ones that are conducted by the Fed and the BCE, but, I mean, at least they give us a guide, we see that loan loss provisions and bank capital are really enough to withstand a very substantial deterioration in non-performing loans as growth rates actually decline, interest rates edge up, and currencies depreciate. So from a banking perspective, because if extreme events do not occur, we think that the region is really strong, and we don't think the weak link is going to be the banking system in the years to come. Now, in the rest of the macroeconomic dimensions, we really don't have one Latin America, but three. First, Chile, Mexico, Peru, and Colombia. I mean, these countries share a few characteristics. They have fluent access to international credit markets. They have access to multilateral financing. They have inflation targeting regimes. The international liquidity position is very strong. I mean, international reserve plus available credit lines are more than enough to pay off all the debts upcoming in the next year, even if no access to credit markets was available. They have a very strong inflationary outlook. All these countries are expected to either fall below or remain 4% inflation rate in the next 3 years. And they have a very, very strong fiscal outlook. If you do the debt dynamics for the next 15 years, given reasonable assumptions, all these countries remain comfortably below the 50% critical to GDP, critical threshold for public debt. So in a sense, the great challenge for these countries is to try to consolidate their macroeconomic strength, in the words of Carlos Vega and Guillermo Bulletin, to try to graduate into countries that really manage very well their macroeconomic policies. On the other hand, we have Argentina and Venezuela. Argentina and Venezuela share the characteristic that they do not have access to international credit markets, that they do not have access to multilateral financing, that they do have exchange rate and capital controls and a huge wedge between the official exchange rate and the black market exchange rate. They have a very weak international liquidity position, very weak fiscal position, inflationary financing of fiscal deficits because they have no access to credit, and the prospects are that inflation is going to remain very high in the years to come if nothing changes. So the challenges for these countries are really humongous. On the other hand, in the case of Argentina, we can talk about Venezuela later because the politics of Venezuela is more complicated in a sense. Many countries had these challenges before, and actually doing the right thing, things can be corrected in a relatively short period of time, even though the challenges are not, in a sense, are not small. Brazil is an intermediate case. Brazil has access to international credit markets and multilateral financing, has inflation targeting regime, relatively low inflation, a relatively strong international liquidity position, but lower growth and higher interest rates put Brazil in a non-convergent path of debt dynamics. And in fact, Brazil already has a relatively high public debt-to-GDP ratio to begin with. So in our opinion, Brazil has time, but given the new and more adverse economic conditions, it will have to do the homework, especially on the fiscal side, to avoid debt from increasing at a rapid rate and losing the credit standing that Brazil now enjoys. So from a development challenge perspective that Kemal was referring to, the last decade was very substantial for Latin America because it meant the interruption of 50 years of relative income decline vis-a-vis advanced economies. In the last 10 years, the Latin American region started to catch up slowly but surely with the income levels of advanced economies. Now, when you look behind the scenes and look at the growth drivers, the very important ones, physical and technological infrastructure, human capital, innovation, quality of public services, trade, integration to the world economy in its many dimensions that we can discuss in the Q&A. Then the picture that emerges is that convergence on these growth drivers towards advanced country levels has essentially been minimal. So this supports very strongly the hypothesis that it was actually mostly favorable external tailwinds that were behind this convergence 10-year period rather than domestic tailwinds induced by a very substantial process of reform in some key areas. Only Chile really has made progress in the last 25 years that puts the country on a road to potentially converge to the lower level of advanced country incomes in a minimum of two generations. So even for Chile, it is going to take time. And finally, I would like to add very briefly what are the political economy challenges at a time when, as we say, the cruising speed of the economy is lower. Therefore, the governments are going to be pressured to rekindle growth and to continue active redistribution policies that were pursued in the last decade, but with fewer resources and with an electorate and with a high degree of social discontent that has been expressed through social protests and by the decline in the popularity of outgoing presidents during the cooling off period relative to the outgoing presidents during the exuberance period. Why do I think governments are going to do the right thing? First, because by and large, democracy has matured enough in the region that we might be more confident than we were before in the sense that the right decisions are going to be made. And second, and with this I finish, that paradoxically, it is in more trying times that the incentives to undertake politically complex but socially necessary reforms are stronger. As a famous economist once said, it is in bad times that the politically impossible becomes politically inevitable. So,
thank you very much.
Come on.
Thank you very much, Ernesto. This was a very good, comprehensive overview of the substantive research, very well summarized. Given that you and your colleagues are the authors, we allowed you a little more time, but now we have to stick to our 10-minute rule, otherwise we won't have much discussion. And I turn to Jose Juan.
Yeah, thank you, Kamal. Thank you, Ernesto and Brookings, for inviting me and having the opportunity to share this incredible panel. I will make a confession. In the last couple of years, it's time I have come to this kind of meetings, similar meeting. This is not the normal meeting, of course. This is Brookings, and these are the cleverest boys in town to talk about Latin America. But we have had many meetings talking about Latin America in the last couple of years. I must confess that I have been fearing the moment in which some of the panelists were going to say one or sometimes the three of the sentences I am going to tell you just now. The first is, the party is over. The second is, tailwinds are turning to headwinds. And the third one is, there is no room for complacency. These are the three sentences in which, in the last couple of years, we have been analyzing Latin America. And I am very happy now. To some extent, I welcome the moment in which this fact that Latin America is not growing anymore is going to put an end to this kind of discussion. We are not going to talk about risk. We are going to talk about something that is just now on the table. And on the table is the facts, the numbers, the data. And Latin America in the year 2014, it's very difficult. It can grow above 1.5%, which is 50% of the potential growth. And if you look at the consensus forecast for next year, you see that Latin America next year, in the best scenario, is not going to grow above 1%. We are going to have really very mediocre rates of growth in the year to come. Maybe in 2016, we are going to see other brighter panorama. I think this is, in my view, what keeps awake the Minister of Finance in the region, lack of growth. And this is important, and maybe if I were a policymaker, I will turn back to the expert, to Augusto, to Ernesto, to Alex, and I will ask, why? If all the risks you and your colleagues has been telling us that we're going to have an impact on Latin America, if those risks has not fully deployed all the negative impact they can have, why the elasticity of Latin American growth to this new and worse external environment is having such an effect? because the slowdown in Latin America is tripling the slowdown that we have in the world economy, or it's nearly doubling the slowdown that we have got in Africa, in Asia, in the Asian economies. I think this is quite an intriguing question, and we need to try to answer this question to policymakers, because we are going to advise them in other areas that are important and that we need to have their support. Maybe you can try a very easy answer to this question. You can go and try to make the accounting of how this expectation of growth in Latin America has been marked down. And if you go to this accounting method, what we were saying at the beginning of at the end of 2013 and what we are now getting, what you will get is something like this. You have a markdown of nearly 2.4%, and this markdown in the rate of growth will be explained 1 full percentage point by the decline in Brazil, 0.6% by the decline in GDP expectation growth in Argentina, 0.6 by Venezuela, 0.2 by Peru, 0.2 by Chile. You will see Colombia is making a neutral contribution, and you will see that Mexico is making a positive contribution on 0.4%. And this is something that, in some way, is what Ernesto has been talking to you as the result of the research. There is a lot of ways to interpret these accounting numbers. One of these is to say, okay, those which are more exposed to commodity prices are having a much more faster reaction. But I think what markets and the private sector is reacting is not just to the shock per se. The markets are responding to the capacity of response of these countries. And I think this is what we are seeing when we look at the numbers and we look the declining forecast. What we are seeing is how markets perceive the possibilities to react to these shocks and how markets perceive the probability of having a change in this model, in this capacity, institutional capacity and policy quality to answer the shocks. And I think this is very important, because what we are seeing is not just that growth is going from the south to the north of Latin America, but maybe growth is going from those which has not been very, very fast and very commit to make reforms to those which have been making reforms in the last couple of years. Let me try to answer the question that Kemal say about real convergence. Kemal, if you go and see what has happened to real GDP per capita in Latin America and you compare to the United States, and you see which was the gap with the United States for each of the 26 Latin American countries that belong to the IDB, what you see is that except Dominican Republic, Chile, and Panama, Latin Americans of today have a larger GDP gap in terms of GDP per capita as against the median American citizen that they have their grandfathers and their parents in 1960. The GDP differential, it's much bigger. It's not much bigger. It's 10% bigger than it was in the 60s. And why this has happened? It has not happened because Latin America has not been able to invest, although it could make a lot of more investment. Has not been able to increase human capital. It is not because it has not been able to create more formal jobs. No, the problem is total factor productivity. Total factor productivity has been declining for a long period of time. And maybe we have been too technical, too specific looking at the productivity and looking for economic factors. And we have overlooked some other impact on why this productivity is not growing as fast as we desire and we need. I think that we have the problem of inequality and crime, and we are not making an assessment of what are the impact of inequality in Latin America and crime on productivity growth. We need to grow more, to be more inclusive, but maybe we need to be more inclusive to have higher productivity rates of growth in Latin America. And the second point, I think it's, and this goes directly to those which were saying that we were, the party's over. This, I don't think that the party's over, but the party which is over is the party of the 80s or the 90s. At least Latin America, in my view, has not been in a party. What has happened in Latin America in the last 15 years has not been a party. It's not the kind of idea I have of what a party is. What Latin America has been having in those years is a process of learning with democracy. Between 2009 and 2016, Latin America is going to have 35 electoral presidential elections. 35. It's the first time in the whole history of Latin America that this is going to happen. And from September 2009 to now, to September, and this month of October, we are going to have election in Bolivia, we are going to have election in Uruguay, and we are going to have election in Brazil. This is going to make nearly 30 electoral process has been already complete in Latin America at the end of this month. What we are seeing is that support to democracy continues to be high in Latin America, but the turnover in the electoral process are going down. And third, what the Congress that are resulting for this electoral process are much more fragmented than they were in the past. And if we want to push productivity and reforms, we need to have a look, a serious look, at what is going on in the political economy and the Congress in which the policymakers has to approve these reforms. We have to inform them of what we know and we don't know of how to promote productivity growth. We need to do much more effort from the multilaterals, from the academia, trying to explain which are the reforms that has the largest impact on growth according to what we have been experienced. We have published very recently our book about institution on productive development, what used to be called in Latin America industrial policies. We are trying to put a framework to think how we can help these policymakers, which are going to be in a very, very competitive, in a very hard situation because growth is going to be low, to make reforms. Because the consequence of this low growth, and I just finish here, is there is some kind of impossible trinity between low growth, continuation of social policies that has made are responsible for the huge progress we have made in social indicators and the orthodoxy of macroeconomic policy. This is an impossible trinity. If low growth is there, something is going to be dispelled. Either the social policies, which means that we are not going to have the social climate we have had in the past, or we are going to be back to that policies despite the fact that institution has been created and are responsible for and has been very responsible in the last couple of years.
Thank you, José Juan. Augusto, any optimistic streak that may emerge or?
You know, I am always
putting any pressure.
I'm always kind of like glasses half full guy, so it's good to be like that because I think my colleagues may be a little bit more towards the other side. I want to add just three or four thoughts to what has been said so far to characterize the type of dialogue and policy debate we're having in the region in this context. You know, there are two questions regarding the current juncture. How bad is going to be this cycle? And what's the nature of this cycle? And how bad is going to be the trend of growth going forward? And I don't think we have very good answers on the two. Some have the impression that the deceleration that we have experienced between 2012, 2013, and 2014 has already marked kind of the lower point of the cycle, and maybe we will be going back to something, which we don't know what the something is. Others are more pessimistic and think there's more yet to come in terms of deceleration. But I think where we seem to have a growing consensus, which was, I think, reflected in both interventions before, is that what we are experiencing is not the same type of bust followed the boom, which was more of the Latin American syndrome of the 90s. So this doesn't look like a big bust and implosion of finance and debt, but more of a significant deceleration that's looking more like a traditional business cycle. That's the good news. The bad news is, of course, that deceleration is very painful. The question as to where we will go back after the low part of the cycle is over is, again, uncertain. But I think there's some coincidence that it's not going to be the type of growth rates that we had before, that we seem to be moving to something more in the neighborhood of 3% over the trend. And that's low. That is a growth that will create quite a bit of tensions. And so I think my colleagues are absolutely right that the type of conversation we will have going forward is going to center on two big issues. It's going to be less centered compared to the past on macroeconomic instability and financial turmoil type issues, and it will probably be much more centered in the issue of long-term growth with equity, which is, of course, going to be very hard to achieve given what we're experiencing. So if that are going to be the things that we're going to be talking about, let me tell you kind of two or three dimensions which I find fascinating in this conversation. First of all, is that this low growth that we are seeing towards the future is going to be affected one way or another by the fact that we have been and are likely to be a low-saving region. In America, saves much less than the Asian countries. And low saving in the region has affected our region in different ways in the past than perhaps it will affect in the future. In the past, how do the low savings used to translate in the region? It used to translate into a penchant, a kind of a systematic tendency to have current account deficits. And the current account deficits with often generate problems of balance of payments by ability and crisis in the external debt trajectories. And so the low savings in Latin America during the 80s and the 90s was associated with countries that had a high risk of default. So Latin America had very low ratings compared to the Asian countries. We were perceived as high default risk countries. And as a result of that, we lived with problems of instability in the balance of payments and with relatively depreciated real exchange rates. In fact, in a recent work that I'm doing with Alanise, we find that Latin America in the 80s and 90s appeared, relative to benchmarks, as a relatively undervalued region. What happened in the 2000s is that we ate away that undervaluation. And we went from fear of depreciation of the 80s and 90s to fear of appreciation in the 2000s. So the 2000s were a period during which most countries, you see Colombia, you see Brazil, you see Costa Rica, ate away whatever external competitive advantage they may have had, which was largely due to the fact that we were high default risk region. Now we are the reverse. We have become a good asset class, with some exceptions, of course, of some nationalities that shall not be mentioned here. But in general, Latin America, when you take the five inflation targetings and you look at the ratings of these countries, they are above those of the Southeast Asian. So we have now are no longer seen as a default risk region. We are a better asset class, like the Wall Street guys will say. And so the low savings are not likely to hit us in the future through this balance of payments, high fast. My sense is that in the future, low savings will hit us by disabling our capacity to be externally competitive from the real exchange. You know, as Charlie Beck has taught us in several of his textbooks, when you have low savings, you have a fundamental that prevents countries to become externally competitive. And so Latin America is going to have to learn to find a path to growth in an environment, and it's going to be very hard for the region as a whole to have really competitive real exchange rates, which I think were part of the Asian growth story. Those countries grew fast, I think, to a large extent, helped by this overall protection that the tradable sector received through very competitive real exchange rates. So I think this is something that we have to think about, because for Latin America, a low-saving region operating now through this lack of external competitiveness, it means that to get really long-term growth going, it's going to be a hard, very difficult task. If you are in China or in Vietnam and your real exchange rate is very competitive, then your structural reforms to get productivity going may pay off easier and faster. But in Latin America, our structural reforms to get productivity growth going are going to have to overcome the problem that we have this drag of low competitiveness. So I think this is an important point to think about, because what it means is that Latin America will have to make some sort of a saving effort, keep the current account deficits from exploding, and the incentives are going to be there in the future to open the current account deficits. Because as we are now better rated countries, we will be more able to finance our deficits, and there will be quite a bit of social pressures to keep consumption up. Therefore, I think we may go besides, this is a region that deleveraged a lot, so there's room to borrow. So this is what I think the syndrome that we have to keep in mind. So the idea of keeping fiscal discipline, keeping fiscal public consumption down and tight, avoiding excessive widening of the current account deficit and its financing, is going to be a challenge for the region. And the more we open the current account deficits, the less competitive in equilibrium our real exchange rate will be, as long, of course, we go back into the times of high default risk, in which case our real exchange rates will depreciate. But I don't think we'll go into the period of high default risk. So I think in equilibrium, to the extent that the current account deficits do not raise the threat of default risk, the cost we're going to pay is a relatively uncompetitive external situation. So the region will have to do a lot on the productivity side. But it's a region that has no experience in that dimension. You know, when I get invited to go to China, I get invited to talk about financial crisis and inflation targeting and exchange rate management. Nobody has invited me to talk about growth in China. Because they know that we know very little about it in Latin America. We know a lot about macroeconomic stabilization. And we have learned a lot about targeting our social assistance better. So we also get invited to talk about conditional cash transfers now, which is an addition. But we are not invited to talk about growth because we know very little about it. And we have to recognize that. And the task before us is so massive that we are going to have to find a way to learn fast. And think of every dimension that may matter for productivity growth, and you will see that we are behind. So think of infrastructure. When was the last time you saw a big infrastructure upgrading wave in Latin America? Probably the 60s. That's where we built good roads and bridges, and we had the Alliance for Progress and what have you. Since then, even though we now have resources, we haven't been able to put together any vigorous improvement of infrastructure because we have lost even the institutional capacity to do so. That may have been a casualty of the Washington Consensus, where we kind of dismantled our ability to prioritize public investment, to find out what the social cost-benefit analysis is. And I don't find in any country that I have seen, including Peru, a very strong institutional capacity to put together a wave of infrastructure upgrading. Think of education quality. We have brought the kids to school, but the quality of our public education leaves a lot to be desired. And when you see the way in which countries like South Korea or Singapore can raise, and now China, can raise the quality of public education, we are quite behind. Think of innovation and the ability of firms to grow and to latch on to global value chains. Latin America is quite behind. So I don't want to belabor this point, and I want to finish here. The point that I want to make is that this dual challenge of keeping a progressive distributional agenda, which we experienced in the 2000s, and lifting growth before beyond the 3%, it's going to be very tough in a region that is already going to be battling with a tendency to have fairly uncompetitive real exchange rates. The social agenda has other dimensions, which I want to just mention to leave it for the conversation later on, which is I do not see how we can make progress in the social agenda without figuring a path for a recontracting of the social contract. We have now a region where about 34% of the population is middle class, and only 25% of the population is poor. We changed the social structure in 10 years. But those that have become middle class and that have left poverty, they have very little incentive, it seems, to be engaged with a social contract. The first thing they do when they become middle class is they take the kids out of public schools, they privatize education. They move to a neighborhood that has walls and private security, so they privatize security. And if they live in Dominican Republic, they buy their own electric generator, so that they don't have to depend on the public services of electricity. So we have a new class with more purchasing power that doesn't want to be engaged in this social contract of citizenship, paying taxes, demanding better quality of public education, etc., as we would like. And so this reconstructing the social contract for me is part of this huge challenge on the distributional agenda, which of course will be harder to manage in a low growth context.
Thank you, Eric. Alejandro.
Thanks, Kemal, and thanks, Ernesto, for inviting me to comment on this work and to comment on what we have heard. And I mean, I would start by saying that was a half full, half empty glass. It was pretty pessimistic as well. And I think what we have seen and what we have heard here is a view that, I mean, Latin America has done quite well in the last 10 years. I mean, from what I'm hearing and the work that we have done as well, I mean, basically that's a result of having managed the macro relatively well in the last 15 years and having gone through one of the largest terms of trade booms in the history of Latin America and managing this boom better than in the past. Now we are going to a scenario in which the terms of trade are going to be constant to declining and more on the declining phase, still very high from a historical perspective. But basically the boost to growth came from two things, from the growth in the terms of trade and also from starting of a situation of a significant scarce or low capacity utilization that gave this economy a lot of room to grow. Now we are much closer to full capacity utilization, no growth to declining in the terms of trade, and that for the commodity exporting countries, it's a big negative shock. The rest of the region, basically Central America and Mexico, had a pretty bad golden decade with very mediocre rates of growth. And now, I mean, with the U.S. expected to pick up in terms of growth in the next 2 to 3 years, they might get a positive boost coming out of this. But obviously, this is nothing in comparison to the shock that South America had last decade. So the region as a whole is going to be doing pretty poorly, and we are back to the strong growth determinants, the hard determinants of growth. I mean, Jose Juan talked about total factor productivity growth. We just heard about savings. And I mean, regarding whether we think the challenge is going through real exchange rate depreciation, et cetera, or through the capacity to invest and mobilize local resources to boost your investment rate. At the end of the day, population is not going to be growing as fast as it did in the past. We don't invest a lot, and we don't have a lot of productivity. To change any of those three things, we need education, increase the saving rates, and increase productivity. These are, very slow-moving processes, politically costly transitions that have to be implemented. And I think the key question there, and going back to what Ernesto was saying, is how the political economy will evolve, hopefully to maintain macroeconomic stability in an environment of low growth. And I think that's the key questions for the next 4 years is that one. And the key question for the next decade is, are we going to embark in structural reforms to increase the trend rate of growth for the next 10 to 15 years? And I think that's the key challenge that we're seeing now in Latin America. Then I think what it said in this study is in some dimensions, Latin America is much less vulnerable than it was in the past. I mean, we significantly reduced leverage. Our banks are well capitalized and well regulated. Our financial markets are working relatively well. Public debts have significantly increased maturities and shifted towards the local currency, et cetera, et cetera. So the big problem going forward is if we're not going to build these vulnerabilities in the next 3 years, in which growth will be coming down. Although the Fed is going to start normalizing monetary policy, we will still be living in a world of ample liquidity and low financing costs. So this possibility of what Augusto was saying, of the temptation to continue expanding aggregate demand and redistributing, et cetera, financing this with a financing environment that without volatility, but might still be too lenient, too benign to these countries, it's a real possibility in which some vulnerabilities can be built in. I do think that, although, I mean, I fully agree with this disenchantment with a society point of view in terms of public services, there has been positive movements in Latin American societies vis-a-vis, I mean, the support for macro stability. I think there's much more support than what we saw before. I think flexible exchange rates and independent central banks are an extremely good instrument to have to avoid building extreme vulnerabilities like the ones we had in the past. And these forces will be at work. But still, I mean, I think these next 3 years will be a significant stress test for a lot of societies that were able to resolve a lot of their social and economic challenges through a significant abundance of resources coming from the commodity-oriented sectors. So I definitely share the views that we have heard here. I would also, I mean, just to empty the glass a little bit more from where I got it, and say that even if we embark in a very strong structural reform effort, structural reforms in the short run might be negative for growth. I mean, while we discuss structural reforms, there are significant increases in uncertainty, and economic agents reduce investment during these periods. I mean, we're seeing that in Mexico, in Chile, et cetera. I mean, these discussions took a year and a half, et cetera. And during these discussions, you don't know exactly how the tax system is going to transform itself after a reform. And therefore, there's a lot of wait-and-see attitudes. If you also are opening up the economy or some key sectors, the established interest pull back and wait until they wait until they see what's coming, but also what is coming might not be good for them. So until new entrants start coming in, then investment suffers. So this will be a painful process that will have positive in the medium term and might complicate the situation a little bit more. The positive news on my side is we are seeing that things are moving on the structural reform side. I think what we have seen in Mexico, after many years of low growth, is eventually a consensus on moving ahead on opening some key sectors, energy, telecommunications, etc. I seen the discussion in Chile of reforming their fiscal system to support a strong reform on the education side. In Colombia, we are hearing also positive things on the fiscal side, on infrastructure, etc. And the whole region, as in general, is talking about structural issues. So I think there is a hope. I think the situation is much better suited than in the past to address an environment of low growth and stability. And I think if we are able to go through the next 5 years in a scenario as the one that is presented in this report of low, mediocre growth, but we look at these last 20 years in Latin America with the stability and the average rates of growth that these projections will give us, it will be a great decade for Latin America. It will have, I mean, I think so the seeds for a significant push for growth in the future. And the big risk is if during these stress tests, we have some political systems that actually try to stretch the limits of macro policies to stimulate growth when the true constraint to growth is on the supply side.
Thank you very much, all of you. And let me just start the discussion. We'll go to the audience pretty quickly. But I heard two very fundamental messages from all of you. Apart from the demand drivers, which Ernesto already outlined very, very well in the beginning, the external side of things, but from the internal side. One was, and I think it was Augusto who really stressed that, the low savings environment. Okay, and the other one was the total factor productivity, sluggish growth of total factor productivity. Now, from a supply side, when you think of growth from the supply side, I mean, these two things are really fundamental. Demand fluctuates at the end of the day. Now, of course, if you take a secular stagnation type outlook, you can get into a series of short-term stagnations can last a long time from the demand side. But I think at the end of the day, growth is more of a supply-side affair in the long run, unless demand is really messed up. And from the supply side, what one needs is factors of production, including human capital, of course, but also capital in its various forms, and productivity growth, and total factor productivity growth. And total factor productivity growth, you know, the whole debate on convergence and why convergence in Asia and in other countries, some other countries started taking hold so strongly, it was the catch-up in technology. The many developing countries did not have the institutions in place and the information channels, the capital markets, the foreign investments. But once that whole thing starts, then to get closer to the frontier of technological knowledge becomes easier. It's always easier to adopt a technology that already exists than spend a lot of resources inventing it, okay? So my fundamental question on the total factor productivity side, maybe, you know, some of you want to add to this, and why isn't the catch-up part in Latin America much more rapid as it is in Asia, okay? Now, maybe it is linked to the savings issue, because at the end of the day, to catch up, one has to invest. I mean, you don't just catch up by breathing on it, by, you know, air in, by itself. You have to take initiative. You have to have joint ventures. You have to invest in order to import and adapt the technology. And there, of course, the statistics in terms of Asia and Latin America are dramatic, because Asia's average savings rate, if you include China, is something like 36%. If you exclude China, it's about 30%. In Latin America, I think the average is probably something around 17 or 18%. So it's almost twice as high. And, you know, do we know why? And by the way, I'm particularly interested in this question, because Turkey is Latin America in that sense, you know. Savings rate of 15%. Why are these two factors so, you know, beyond the external drivers? If supply side growth is going to succeed, it has to go through higher savings and higher total factor productivity. Does anybody want to add just something maybe to this, Ernesto?
Well, Kemal, this is a very key, very, very key question. And there are many possible answers to this question, but let me give you one. When you look at the I remember Bob Lucas once wrote a very complex, basically very difficult to read paper titled "The Making of a Miracle," and it's about Korea. So essentially, when you look at the only development miracles that we saw since the 1950s, and this is all coming up in a very interesting volume that Kemal with Komi Haras are editing and contributing to on growth, convergence, and divergence debate. It's going to have 20 contributions, so this is going to have a lot of information on a lot of the regions. But when you look at the only five miracles that we saw since the 1950s, there were only five that actually achieved the fate of becoming rich, starting from very low levels of income relative to the U.S. or advanced economies. All of them were Asians. Japan, Taiwan, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Korea. That's it. No more miracles. When you look at what really happened, during the period, and this took place in a period between 25 and 45 years. So this was not eternity. I mean, it occurred very rapidly. That's why we call them miracles. If you look at what was happening when income was converging, you look at the drivers, and you see human capital was converging towards advanced economy levels. Infrastructure and technology was converging towards advanced economy levels, and integration was converging very rapidly in the sense that the countries were becoming extremely open as they developed, in the sense that the process was accompanied by a huge increase in exports and imports, an integration into the global value chains, and an increase in intra-regional trade. When you look at Latin America, any of the processes that actually looked like we were starting convergence, the last 10 years, where we see nothing of that. No convergence in human capital, no convergence in physical and technological infrastructure towards advanced country levels, no convergence in terms of the integration of our economies into the world economy. We have very low levels of integration compared to Asia still. We are practically outside the circuit of global supply chains, and we have extremely small intra-regional trade. So one of the reasons I think we are not seeing this is because, and I think this is very important, the region has not integrated enough, not only between among the countries in the region, but with Canada and the U.S. So I think that we need to recreate the spirit that we had in the 1994 summit, when we thought that we could create a large region where goods, eventually people could move freely between Alaska and Tierra del Fuego. And we think that the ingredients are there to recreate that, because already 11 countries in Latin America have free trade agreements with the U.S. So it is only a question of creating a new Trans-American partnership where we harmonize the rules of origin among the countries that already have FTAs with the U.S., and we can create a huge economic space that might give the impetus for many of these things that we need doing. But I think that a lot of this happens when you integrate into a larger economic space and you create the external incentives in order to do a lot of the reforms that we need to do, rather than do them on our own, country by country, fighting with a very complex political economy.
So, and you want to say?
Yeah. No, I think the question is a key point for what is going to happen in the region. But if you try to make a short answer, I would say that we have too few big companies and too many micro companies. I think the structure of the economy in Latin America has a lot to do about the incentives to innovate and not innovate. Big companies maybe are less interested because the economy is less diversified to integrate domestic companies in the value chains. In fact, we came to Mexico last week, and one of the things that the authorities are trying to do is how to integrate these small and medium companies in the strategy of the big companies and to create these value chains that were not created. I think this is important because the micro companies, which are not just in the formal economy, but many of them in the informal economy, have less finance, less training, less capacity to integrate export and import. And I think this can make a big difference, as I can say. The result of this structure is that the level of diversification of the economies in Latin America, it's low. When you go and see what are the main exports of Latin America, you see that in the first 10 items exported by Latin America, 7 out of 10 are commodities. You only have 3 exports that are computers, video displays, cars, and the 3 of them are made by Mexico. And if you go to the 15th export of Latin America, you say that you have 5 out of 15 are 10 out of 15 are commodities, the cars, computers, and video displays. You have trucks, and you have trucks and integrated circuits. And again, it's Mexico and Costa Rica. And if you go to the 20, you have just 6, and you don't add too many countries. I think it's very concentrated. It's not as diversified as the Asian structure, and I think I don't know if this is the result or the consequence of having low innovation, but it has something to do, clearly has something to do.
Okay, we have to open a little bit. There will be one, you know, very quick message from each of the panelists at the very end anyway, but we are running out of time, so let's get some questions from the floor. If there are, of course. Yes?
Charlie.
Teresa?
Just to ask a question of whoever wants to respond, and that is how you see, first of all, the likelihood and then the consequences of Brazil undertaking next year a significant adjustment, which in terms of the fiscal structure have to be quite substantial if you take into account all the sort of quasi-fiscal problems that, or practices that have occurred. How is that going to impact domestic demand and the possibility of growth? And do you see any real chances of a structural reform effort sort of being undertaken after, it has not been undertaken for the past, many years, basically, in better economic and social conditions than the country's going to have next year.
We'll take a few questions if there are. Yes, here.
Hello, Albert, Exim Bank. My question is regarding something that you have been talking about. It's total factor productivity. It seems also that in Latin America we have like dual economies that are a parallel. One that is like growing very quickly and it has a lot of technology, and you were talking about it, like flat screen, maybe aeronautical equipment and medical equipment going back and forth between North America and Mexico. And we have another that has like little value added, that we're talking about this concentration about the markets again. What would be the policy advice that you give to Latin America to have a better windfall through all the sectors and not just like pockets of development?
There was one question there at the very back.
José Miguel Pulido con Mitsui & Co. I wanted to ask, the Pacific Alliance countries' attempt at integration with Asian economies, what sort of effect will that have on TFP growth? Thank you.
Okay. Maybe I'll take Two more questions, yeah. There in the back, and then you, yeah.
Yeah, Andy Powell from the IDB. That was, as Alex said, that was kind of the most cup half empty speech I've heard from Augusto from a long time. but I want to make it a little more empty. So I think I heard you say that our leverage had declined, and that may be true, you know, for the public sector compared to before the crisis. But I mean, public sector debt's been increasing quite rapidly given the deterioration in the fiscal, and then private sector debt has increased substantially. So our financial systems now are roughly doubled in size if you look at credit to the non-financial private sector in the last 4 or 5 years. And then private companies have been issuing a lot abroad in dollars. So I'm a little worried. You know, there was this thing in the UK that we called the Lawson fallacy, right? Which is if you have persistent current account deficits, but it's the private sector, then somehow it's okay. And as the name suggests, that came home to roost quite forcibly in the UK. So, I agree with you that I think, you know, we'll avoid any financial crisis, but the business cycle can be substantially amplified, let's put it that way, if we get into a leveraging and deleveraging cycle. And I suspect that we're, especially looking at private sector financing, we're, you know, maybe at the top of a cycle.
Okay, the last question.
Carlos Veg. From Johns Hopkins. Yeah, so just a quick comment to get a reaction from the panel. It seems to me that the big boom of the last 10 years or so, I mean, was mainly driven by capital inflow and high commodity prices. I think that we can agree. And the reaction that I like to get from the panel is that I feel that a factor that perhaps has not been stressed enough is that we have lost an opportunity to do more in those good times, because I feel that it is very hard to do good stuff in bad times. I mean, when bad times come, you have to put out the fire, and you can do a little less. It is in good times that I feel Latin America should have been built even more. Fiscal pace should have been trying to deal with the issue of monetary policy procyclicality that leads to the cycle of sharp appreciation and then sharp depreciation in bad times, and also that is the time in times of bonanza when attacking structural reforms are the easiest. So it was not that a lost opportunity to do more.
And I will ask one last thing, and then each one of our panelists will go in the reverse order, starting with Alejandro and ending with Ernesto. But, you know, just really 1 minute, if you have one thing to add, because one of our Brookings tradition is we try to finish on time so that people can follow the schedule. But my question is, when we say integration, and then I don't even expect an answer, it's just, you know, if you look at integration within countries as well as integration with the world, we have very good stories and we have bad stories. The Asian integration into the world economy was fantastic, obviously, and Ernesto underlined it. But it was also a very managed integration, an export-oriented integration. It was not just an opening of borders and then let the private sector do everything. It was a very managed integration, an export-driven integration. If you look at integration within countries, and that deeply worries me in Europe, for example, Italy has been an integrated country for decades, right? And yet the gap between the north and the south has increased, if anything. So I just want to, put a little damper on the view that markets and integration and good macro policy alone can do the trick. I think all panelists stress the supply side, starting with Ernesto's emphasis on the drivers and infrastructure, for example. But my own feeling is that Latin America will require a strong private-public partnership with the public leadership, not big state sector, but public leadership actually playing a very strong strategic role in making the supply side happen. If it just integrates into the world economy or just creates an American free trade zone, I'm not quite sure that will be enough to generate the supply response that's needed. Sorry, but that prerogative of the chair. Anyway, so, Alejandro, we start, and one major point you would like to make, or two, and then we'll have to
just two points responding. I mean, what Teresa said, I think Brazil is at the crossroads. I mean, they would have had next year 5 years of low growth. There's an important macro adjustment to be done. We have discussed it in our Article 4, et cetera, so people know where we stand. But also, I think there's a very strong growth agenda to be deployed, in which hopefully significant consensus can be built. I mean, we have seen some things being put in the table during this campaign, but I think the key issue, the macro thing, there's some consensus. On the structural issues, I think it would be a big, big challenge for Brazilian society to carry and to generate support for that, and that they cannot grow much faster than 2-2.5% if they don't go ahead with strong structural things. In terms of leverage that Andy was saying, I think it is true when you look at Latin America from a 10-year perspective. I mean, there have been countries in which the financial system has grown a lot. And I think if you actually stress test, I don't know the stress test that Ernesto was talking about. We did some with our FSAPs. But I think if you stress the macro significantly from 5% growth to 2% growth, unemployment going up, real wages going down, etc., there might be some surprises that we think can be handled within the current strength of the capitalization ratios, but it would be we can have strong surprises. On the side, we are not as concerned, but if this thing continues growing, maybe it continues to shift to the high yield, less sophisticated and unnaturally hedged sectors, and that could be a concern. And finally, on Kemal's point, I think policy consistency and therefore policy uncertainty, both on the macro, but more than that, on the microeconomic front in Latin America, is a huge deterrent of investment.
Yeah, just a couple of thoughts on this conundrum of low productivity growth and low savings. I think that productivity growth is very much associated with the capacity of societies to learn, and to learn through production, to learn through investment, to learn through trade. And Latin America has traditionally been a society that learns less from FDI, from international trade, from investing than other societies. Discovering why is it that we have this kind of deficit in the ability to learn is, I think, key. I think some of it is related to the fact that we documented in our most recent flagship report that our more well-regarded companies, the bigger formal companies, the exporters, even the multilatinas, tend to be less vigorous in their ability to grow and generate jobs than the similar companies elsewhere. So Latin America has this sort of growth stunting phenomenon where companies, even when they are good, they don't grow fast enough and provide a type of scales effects and their clustering effects that can perhaps provide this ability for societies to grow. So figuring out exactly why is it that our companies, that even the good ones, either don't want to grow more or can't grow more is part of, I think, understanding the situation. The reason I think that's because these companies don't grow more, either because they don't want it or because they can't, that's why I think we have such a huge universe of micro enterprises. Because if the larger enterprises are not providing good jobs, you have no choice but to create your little unproductive little shop. So figuring out better what type of policies can generate this space and incentives for the larger companies to connect, to grow faster, to integrate into global value chains is, I think, key in solving this mystery. For me, what worries me is that, contrary to what people think, that will probably require a fairly disciplined fiscal process, because only a fairly disciplined fiscal process will allow the learning process to be helped by a competitive real exchange rate. I think that's part of the Asian miracle. Without something that holds the exchange rate competitive, a fundamental, which has to come from the fiscal side, it's going to be very hard to create this kind of overall umbrella space for companies to take advantage of the learning opportunities. But doing that will hit against the wall, against the social policy and distributional needs. And there is where I see the tug of war that the region will have to be battling with in the future.
Thank you. So Juan, very briefly.
Yeah, very briefly. Picking up the point raised by Augusto, I think it's fascinating. I think that one of the reasons that maybe this value chain and this integration are not happening, it's because in Latin America, you have a gap in trust. The reliability of how it's going to perform your partners, it's a very important business event in the economy. Rule of law, insecurity, these makes that you prefer to integrate vertically your activity, because to depend on foreign suppliers could be extremely important or extremely risky strategy. And I think one of the reasons for having this lack of integration also has to do with the rewards to failure and success in Latin America. A failure in Latin America is a real failure. You fail and you are not going to have maybe another opportunity to rise to where you were, because inequality is there. This is one of the reasons that people have something similar to a roles justice concept. I don't try to do better, because if I fail, I will be in a much worse of position than I am now. And to grow and to be an entrepreneur means to take risk. And to take risk in Latin America could be really a very risky activity. I think that these are also very important things to keep in mind, because the private sector thinks in these terms. And I think they are right.
Ernesto, last word.
Thank you, Yoman. We ran a little bit over because this is a Latin a Latin panel, so Brookings might make a little bit of a concession for our regional tendencies. So I'll be brief anyway. Good times are bad times for politically complex reforms in general, Charlie, because it is very difficult for governments to undertake politically complex, politically costly reforms at a time when things are going fine without doing anything. So the incentives are not there. Very bad times are bad for reform too, because you are trying to put out the fires, as you said. But we are not going into very bad times, I think. We are going into a kind of a growth recession. So these are exactly the times in which you have the incentives to try to do the right things. And this is, I think, Mexico is a good example of that. I mean, it's basically, Mexico has no significant macro problems. It has a growth problem, and Peña Nieto did really important transformations that we were discussing with Alex just before we came. And I think all of Latin America is going to converge towards the Mexican kind of dynamics. So I see reforms in the pipeline coming in. There is a huge demand for that. There's a huge demand for improving our educational systems. And in Brazil, there is a huge demand now from the private sector, which makes me very optimistic on that, on abandoning long-time and long-held protectionist policies. Because with TPP and the transatlantic partnership, Brazil, the private sector in Brazil now feels that they are going to become isolated if they continue with the current policy. So there is a dynamics simmering there in Brazil, which is basically the only important country remaining in order to pursue a more aggressive integration. And I would like to close trying to address what you said, Kemal. I think there's no single path for development. I mean, Asian development was very managed because these were very authoritarian regimes that actually did the trick, I think. Democratization came afterwards. We did it the other way. I mean, we are now very democratic, not very integrated, very difficult to manage from the center things in the way that they were managed in Asia, but then what I see is more like a process, and perhaps this is, I don't know, because of my personal preferences, but of what happened in Spain and Portugal. I mean, these countries democratized first, they integrated into the European Union afterwards, and they did, notwithstanding the current crisis, they developed very rapidly in every dimension as a consequence. I see that process for Latin America more likely to happen than the Asian kind of process.
No, I think that's a very good point. And of course, having said we have to finish, I'm not going to make any comment. But I think this debate is wonderful. I would like to thank, on behalf of all of us, the panelists, Alejandro Augusto, for coming and joining us. And I also very much would thank my friend and colleague Ernesto and his team. We've worked together on the report. It's a very good team, some of them sitting here in the audience. I think we have a strong ESPLA program, a strong program on Latin America. And let me say, ever since I was a student at the London School of Economics, Latin America was always a great laboratory for economists. You know, one hears much less about economists in Germany or in Korea. You know, Latin America is always at the cutting edge of economic debate. Let's hope that it will be also at the cutting edge of real long-term growth. And I think there are some lessons learned, and I think democracy will help. And I fully agree with Ernesto. Thank you very much. Thank you.